Hello, it's Thursday, 4th of March. I'm Gary Bauerman from Check-In Asia. On today's show, we'll be discussing the outlook for travel and tourism in Southeast Asia from an academic perspective with Professor Joseph Chia and Dr. Mary Mostafa Najad. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson. So today, it's our great pleasure to welcome Professor Joseph Chia from the Center for Tourism Research at Wakayama University in Japan, and Dr. Mary Mostafa Najad, Associate Professor at University of Hawaii at Manoa. Hello to you both, and welcome to the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Good morning, Gary. Good morning, Hannah. Hi, Mary.
Good morning, good afternoon, wherever you are. Thanks for having us.
So before we begin, let's find out a little bit about both of your careers and your research. So Joseph, I think you were born in Australia, right? You studied, gained your doctorate there, taught at universities there, and then moved to Japan in 2019. So how did that come about, and what do you focus on for research and teaching?
Well, firstly, commendations for inviting academics on the program. It's a rare privilege, and we hope we can give you something that's of interest. I wasn't actually born in Australia. I was born in Fiji, which is why tourism is kind of in my blood. My parents ran a tourism business in Fiji, and my heritage is Chinese, Polynesian, and Danish. But I lived in Australia for most of my life, and coming to Japan was something that first time I came to Japan, Mary was here as well. And I've always been fascinated by Japan. You know, so many people who know a lot about Japan but have not been here are familiar with Ghibli and, you know, manga and all of those kinds of things. So I wasn't any different to that. Before I became an academic, I worked in the international hotel industry and management consulting, and then for the Australian government's aid program in the Pacific, where we were trying to use tourism as a vehicle for development. My research is, you know, is more or less trying to understand how tourism can produce better outcomes for the people who rely on it. I'm currently working with colleagues at the University of Melbourne on a project to do with the traditional owners of Uluru, formerly known as Ayers Rock in Australia, trying to understand how we can improve livelihood outcomes for them. And in Japan, I've got this fantastic project I'm working on called Wellness Landscapes that allows me to go to onsens or hot springs every now and then to do my field work. So that kind of captures most of it.
So how about you, Mary? So you were born in America, gained your doctorate in Hawaii. So tell us more about what you do and, you know, what's the focus of your research and teaching?
Yeah, so I was born in the U.S. in Oregon, and I grew up in the Oregon and Washington State, so really the Pacific Northwest. But I moved to Honolulu in 2005 to begin my doctorate in anthropology. And I think I moved to Hawaii because I wanted to focus on Southeast Asia. I was fascinated by Southeast Asia. I had traveled there once, or I had traveled there as a master's student and wanted to continue to focus on the region. And so that's what drew me to the University of Hawaii. And so as a graduate student, I continued that focus, and really, most of my research is in Southeast Asia, but particularly in northern Thailand. And so my dissertation work ended up looking at volunteer tourism in northern Thailand. And if you've ever been to Chiang Mai, Thailand, you will know that there were, at least pre-COVID times, there was a thriving volunteer tourism industry. That's pretty common throughout the region at this point, especially in Cambodia as well. And so my focus in tourism has really been on development studies, comes from a development studies perspective. More recently, I've started to look at what in academia we talk about as the political ecology of tourism. And so what that really means in sort of general speak is just looking at the politics and economics that drive environmental change. And I apply that framework to tourism. And so I have an ongoing project that's funded by the National Science Foundation looking at air pollution, seasonal air pollution in northern Thailand. And it's not specifically entirely focused on tourism, but tourism's definitely always in the background, right? So seasonal air pollution definitely affects the number of tourists that go to northern Thailand during this quote-unquote smoky season, which has recently been dubbed the haze crisis. And so some of my work now is more focused on tourism and the environment and socio-environmental change.
Great. Thanks very much for those intros. That really sets up nicely some of the topics that we're going to talk about over the next few moments. Now, you've both published widely, both academic papers and books, and you're editors of Tourism Geographies, an international journal of tourism, place, space, and environment, which is a long-standing academic title. Can you tell us a little bit more about what the current objectives are and if they're changing in sort of the COVID and post-COVID era?
Yeah. You've given us a really good plug there, Gary. Yes. the journal's longstanding. I think it's been going for over 21 years now. The challenge for us as academics, you know, increasingly, is how can we take this really valuable research and make it accessible to more people beyond, you know, the so-called ivory towers of academia, right? Because, you know, we're constantly asking ourselves, what is the point of the research we're doing? Mary and I both do a lot of applied work, right? That is focused on informing policy, that is focused on guiding communities and the industry in relation to what the best courses of action are. So for us, and for this journal in particular, we're trying to publish work that is relevant to as wide an audience as possible, that is academically rigorous, but can inform the policies that are essential in driving better outcomes from tourism. So we've got a new initiative at the moment where we're trying to move towards taking the academic papers and developing them in more bite-sized versions for wider audiences. Because we know that as academics, one of the things that we strive for is how do we connect with government and industry and communities, right? It's not enough alone to do just research for research's sake. So we're constantly asking ourselves that. And the journal Tourism Geographies tries to strike the right balance between knowledge development and knowledge that can help make a difference and contribute to practical advancements, right? And it's a long-held argument, and these days in particular, you know, what is academic research for? There are tensions around that. You know, some people are theorists where they work on theory only, whereas we work on both. So striking the right balance and making us more relevant to a wider audience is really, really essential for us. Mary, you might want to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, so I really just jumped on board as the co-editor-in-chief of the journal. But what I can say is that I feel like the journal's really in a good place at the moment, and there's a lot of momentum in terms of the lineup of editors and authors. And as Joseph just explained, we are trying to expand our readership to reach a broader audience. And so we've developed what sort of an online magazine through Medium called Tourism Geographic. And this is really for academic authors to write short articles for a public audience. And so I'm really excited about that initiative. I'm also really excited about some of the new special issues that we have in the works. So we have a recent issue that we just put out a call for that's led by Alana Dillette from San Diego State University on what she describes as unpacking Black tourism. And so the issue will address some of the longstanding issues around racial injustice in the context of tourism. And of course, there are a range of issues that are significant here, such as race and environmental justice, racial representations in tourism, racialized labor, colonial and post-colonial tourism. And so these are obviously important and in many cases long overdue topics. And I think that I'm really excited about addressing some of these timely topics and some of the special issues that we have scheduled in.
Those sound super interesting, and we'll drop a link to this in the show notes as well, so our listeners can go find them. So Mary, you wrote an article almost a year ago now, I think, called COVID-19 is an Unnatural Disaster. And there you concluded that COVID-19 will reshape tourism as we previously knew it. Yet, while there are reasons to be hopeful, who will benefit from this restructuring is still an unsettled question. What do you make of that paragraph now after everything that's occurred? You know, does that still stand?
Yeah, I mean, that's always an interesting thing to go back to what you wrote a year ago. But I definitely think that statement is perhaps more true now than ever. That paper is really about how the effects of the pandemic would be and have been unevenly felt, and the benefits of the restructuring of tourism in a post-pandemic world will be an RV on are being unevenly shared. In the United States, this definitely could not be any clearer. People of color have died at twice the rate of white people. Here in Hawaii, around 42% of all COVID cases are among Pacific Islander and Native Hawaiian communities, making up a disproportionate percentage. People in low and middle income groups have been disproportionately affected by job loss, and the list goes on. At the same time, and this has been in the headlines everywhere, but U.S. billionaires have increased their wealth by 39% or $1.1 trillion. Right. So there are numerous examples to demonstrate that in general, this has been the case. And I think tourism is an industry. Right. So I think that tourism has really just followed suit with the broader fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so what we see in many cases is that tourism businesses with more capital have used this opportunity, for example, to remodel their infrastructure, and they'll likely be able to weather the storm. Whereas smaller mom and pop shops have already been boarded up en masse. As an example, here in Hawaii, it's estimated that around half of all restaurants will have permanently closed by April. And that's with government aid, including the Federal CARES Act funding. And obviously in many countries, including in Southeast Asia, there never was any government aid. And so, yeah, I think that this is definitely the trend that we see happening, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in the tourism industry in Southeast Asia.
Joseph, you touched on this a few moments ago, but let's look at it a bit more broader. You looked at the role of academic research in travel and tourism. I wanted to go back just before the pandemic. Now, how was that role changing, and has the pandemic given a sort of a greater input and profile to tourism academics, and do you think that will go on into the future?
Yeah, this is a really good question, Gary, and it's quite pertinent for us. I mean, for me, as an academic, I would say I'm probably very highly engaged across multiple platforms in terms of talking about tourism, in terms of interacting and linking up with mainstream media and the industry itself. So the question is particularly important more important now, because as academics, you know, we usually are able to sit back. We have the privilege of being able to sit back and analyze things, right? And the question now is, we've had a chance to analyze the outfall of COVID and what it means, as Ms. Mary just explained. And people are asking questions. You know, the big question that we all hear is, you know, what is the new normal for travel going to be like? You know, when can we travel again? And for us to be able to apply the insights we have has become more important now than ever. For example, just before the new year, we wrote an article in the World Economic Forum with my colleagues, Michael Hall and Jaakko Saarinen, where the question we tried to answer was, you know, from an academic perspective, where do we see travel going, and when will we be able to travel again? Of course, we don't have crystal balls, right? But there is an expectation that we do. So, in light of the pandemic, I think our roles have become particularly more important. I can't tell you how many people have reached out to me from the media and in general asking us for insight on this, because usually in industry and in government, it's fast moving, right? Our timelines tend to be quite different as compared to academics. We can have relatively long timelines. So now industry and government are asking us, you know, where do we see all of this going? And for many of us, Mary and included, we don't just work as academics. We also do lots of projects outside of academia with communities, local government, tourism bodies. So, it's more important. And I think in a way, I felt that the pandemic's been beneficial for us, because the search for knowledge, the search for analysis on how things are panning out has become much stronger than, say, when tourism was going well. And, you know, when things are going well, you don't need to stand back and analyze, right? But now, many of us have come to the fore in terms of offering the insights that we have.
So in terms of your teaching, how has that changed? I mean, obviously, I guess everything is having to go a lot more online rather than in person. Are students responding well to that? Have there been challenges?
Totally. I think one of the trending terms and these days will be Zoom fatigue. You know, I don't know if you have Zoom fatigue. I certainly have Zoom fatigue. And, you know, there's this kind of shift, right? Everyone embraced the online environment. But as we get further into the pandemic and hopefully post-pandemic phase, there's this sense, you know, do we still need to do Zoom, or can we go back to face-to-face kind of engagements, right? You know, and for us as academics, going to conferences and talking to people firsthand, having a few drinks together and nutting, going through issues face-to-face is really, really important. I don't feel we can do that in the online environment as well. I mean, colleagues of mine who work in the mice industry say the same thing, right? Can you run an ITB online? Can you run a world travel, you know, London World Travel Market online? I don't really think so. So from our teaching point of view, we face the same things. Students are facing Zoom fatigue. I mean, I teach in Japan, right? So you can imagine I teach in English in Japan, not in Japanese. So Zooming in another language that's not your first language makes it incredibly more taxing. So, but this is important because what we see at the moment, and these are some trends coming through, especially for hospitality and tourism, that's been really hit. There's a brain drain happening, right? People are moving out of the industry into other things that are presumably more secure. And this has serious implications for the industry's workforce. I think, you know, there is already some concern from the UNWTO that when tourism does get going again, and if it gets going again relatively quickly, how do we then, you know, fill all of those positions that have been lost? How do we replenish the small and medium enterprises that are critical to tourism? So our role as building the capacity of the tourism industry workforce is increasingly more important now than it's ever been, because, you know, tourism has often been seen as not so much a career, right, but something that you do until you actually find out what you want to do next. So the challenge for us is how do we continue to build the industry's workforce, and how do we continue to make tourism a viable career option for young people? Because right now, many universities running tourism courses scratching their heads thinking, you know, how are we going to attract students when the industry is in such a state?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Mary, what are your thoughts?
I think students are much more comfortable with online courses than they were even 5 years ago, right? Especially with sort of advancements in the smartphone. I think many are taking their courses from their smartphone. And the pandemic has really sped up a transition that was sort of, in many ways, already happening. And there's been a significant investment in online training and platforms, which has made online teaching easier. But at the same time, just as Joseph was saying, I don't think it's ever going to replace face-to-face instruction. And I think for a lot of students, they need that face-to-face instruction, because the social interactions of education, I think, are not something that we give grades on, but I think that they are really important in students' development and ability to engage in philosophical and other types of questions.
And have you seen a drop-off in the number of applications for students applying for tourism courses?
I'm in the Department of Geography and Environment. And our applications to our grad program have actually increased. And I think our numbers are not down. In fact, they may have gone up a bit. So I'm not sure what accounts for that. But I think our students are still signing up for the courses. And a lot of students looking towards graduate education, especially in a context where jobs are few and far between at this point.
Yeah, usually in times of crisis, people return to study, right? Because when people are unemployed, one of the immediate thoughts are, how do I skill up? And it means going back to uni. So as long as I've been in universities, whenever there's a crisis, people return to universities in bigger numbers.
So when we're talking about travel and tourism with you guys, there are kind of three hats that you guys wear. So there's the academic side, there's the sort of travel industry side, the commercial side, but there's also the personal side as well. So for you guys, how has COVID-19 altered the way that you perceive and approach travel and tourism, both in your work and in your own personal lives?
Well, you know, I think I say this for everyone. We had taken for granted our global mobility, right? And remember the days when you could just get onto a search engine, book some flights, and, you know, go to the airport, jump on it, get your connecting flight. It was so easy, right, as compared to now. So I think for me in particular, my family lives in Australia. I live in Japan, and I haven't been able to visit them for 5 months. So, you know, this idea of being immobile is really quite excruciating, right? but it's made me appreciate what we had before. So in terms of in my own life, I haven't traveled at all for the last 12 months, apart from Australia to Japan to work. To do our research, we need to travel very often, especially for Mary and I. And a lot of our work is in countries outside of the ones we live in. This is an unusual situation for everybody. What does it mean for us? What does it mean for me? I remain quite sanguine about and positive about recovery. I think, when I sit back and think, for me personally, travel is such a vital part of my lifestyle, not just for work, but for my family, friends, and the way I live. I just think that when the opportunity returns, and, we've been talking about what the new normal will bring. Will it be one where we'll be more conscious and responsible and sustainable? And it's funny, most of my colleagues I know who I meet regularly every year at different events around the world are saying, oh, I can't wait for the next one. As soon as the barriers are lifted, I'm going to be on that flight kind of thing. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it very much.
That's neatly encapsulated. I think that does speak for all of us, certainly the four of us here. Mary, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I would just echo what Joseph has said. I think the pandemic has really made me, in many ways, viscerally aware of how important travel is to my sense of sanity. There's something quite humbling about staying in place, though. I will say that my place is currently the island of Oahu in Hawaii, which isn't a bad place to be throughout the pandemic, for sure. And this period has really been an opportunity for me to get to know the island that I've lived on for quite some time a bit more, and I realized that I don't necessarily need to get on a plane to experience something new. At the same time, I'm not ready to trade in my passport for backyard camping, but I think it's definitely given me a new perspective on the place that I live.
So looking at Southeast Asia then, I mean, obviously it faces huge economic, societal and environmental challenges in a post-COVID world. So how will or won't the economic importance of travel and tourism change?
Yeah, well, look, I think this has just amplified the vital place that tourism holds in Southeast Asian economies, right? Or has come to hold. I mean, when 12 months ago, Southeast Asia was doing quite well on the pandemic front. Thailand, Vietnam, I think the rest of the world was looking quite enviously at Southeast Asia, saying, how are they doing it? So how will the economic importance of travel and tourism change? I think if anything, it'll intensify. I think there'll be this desire to make up for lost time. There'll be this desire for economic recovery. I think, while we're talking about hopefully learning lessons from the pandemic and moving forward with those lessons in the way we live, it seems to me I can already see that while those good intentions are there, there'll be this desire to push on with economic recovery, push on with opening the borders and getting tourists back again. I mean, I saw a recent report on the Philippines, right? The Philippines has been the hardest hit because it's one of the countries in the region that is most dependent on tourism. And already they're talking about recovery, and I think they're just chomping at the bit. How can we open up very quickly? But I think when I look at Southeast Asia, to me, one of the main, and I suppose one of the main drivers for tourism growth in Southeast Asia has been the ability to fly around the region relatively cheaply. Most destinations can thank AirAsia for that. If we look at the parlous state that AirAsia is in at the moment because of the pandemic, that would be my main concern or the main stumbling block to regaining that economic impetus that tourism provides is the ability for people to move around the region. Will Southeast Asia be that backpacker place that Europeans and Americans and Australians flock to on their way somewhere else? That would be, I think, the key. And one of the things that in looking at China and in some of the work that I'm doing with colleagues in China, it's clear that long-haul travel is going to diminish, at least for the short term. So people will be looking, especially Chinese travelers, will be looking to travel closer to China. Short and medium haul, and Southeast Asia is well positioned to grab those people who would normally have gone to, say, Europe or North America. So I really am quite positive about the Southeast Asian tourism recovery in that regard.
Mary, what are your thoughts?
I agree with what Joseph has said. In Southeast Asia, you have a growing middle class in most countries that is expanding at sort of very fast rates. And you also have a very large middle class, again, in China, right? And so what you have are, you have budget airlines, and then you have the development of massive rail systems, or at least partially funded by China. And so just the development of easier travel is going to continue to expand domestic as well as regional travel. And I think that's where you're going to see a lot of the immediate recovery. China, obviously, being the largest international market for the region, particularly Thailand, I think that's where you're going to see countries like Thailand sort of focusing their immediate efforts. And for those who still have jobs, you have millions of people who have saved their travel funds and they're ready to go, right? They're itching to get on a plane and have a change of scenery. And so I think Southeast Asia will be at the top of many people's lists, in part because the region has been relatively successful in containing the virus compared to countries such as the US and the UK.
Yeah, it's a really important point that you made there, Joseph, in terms of this need for economic recovery, the papering over the cracks of you know, the economic damage that has been done and the scarring that has been caused over the past year. But as we do move into hopefully a recovery environment, the environment itself will become an issue. It's been travel, tourism, and the environment has been a coming storm for several years. And probably after the pandemic, climate change will assume greater significance. How do you see that balance of the environment and economic recovery sort of panning out in the near term?
Yeah, I think I'm inclined to reserve a judgment on that because behavior change is incredibly difficult, right? To kind of at scale to manage. You know, will people change their behaviors? For example, if we talk about that in particular, the issue of plastic and plastic pollution in Asia, we see that through concerted government action and social awareness, they're making some inroads, right? We see this. I mean, you can imagine the pictures of plastic on Kuta Beach in Bali are quite well known. But I think that the behavior change in that regard is probably going to be a spur for other things. But I think in the end, it will come back to the economics of it all, right? I look at some of the developments in Cambodia, right? Driven by developers, largely from China, especially somewhere like Sihanoukville, for example, stands out as what can possibly happen when it's really all about growth and development. So I think governments in the region will definitely need to have to balance that. We see this in Bali. A mutual colleague of Mary and I, Stroma Cole, she works on Bali quite extensively, and she has long talked about how Bali is running out of water. Yet the number of resorts and golf courses that continue to be developed has continued apace, at least until COVID-19 hit. Will we have learned anything from that? Will the business model of tourism that we've seen so far remain the same? I don't have much faith in policymakers and in the general public to make these massive changes that are required. But I hope to be proven wrong in all of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is increased support, public support for more sustainable forms of tourism, or at least less crowded forms of tourism, perhaps, especially as people are still wary from the pandemic. And so these trends will hopefully shift the industry, which will need to adapt from an economic perspective to stay competitive. And in countries such as Thailand, Vietnam, and Indonesia, you already see this happening in some places. I think the most infamous example in Thailand would be Maya Bay, which has been closed for a few years now because of massive over-tourism. And since the pandemic, I think many residents in kind of eco-tourism areas or areas around national parks have been able to visibly observe the importance of giving environments time to recover. And beginning this year, Thailand has just decided to close national parks for an average of 3 months per year. And so this is huge for Thailand. And it's I think it's the result of people observing what mass tourism and over-tourism and overcrowding has done to the environment. And so there are moves trending that direction, but I agree with Joseph, it's too early to really tell. I mean, when you're talking about behavior change, what you're really talking about is culture change, right? And culture takes time to change, and so to be continued.
Can I just add 2 points there? If we look at the status quo now, political stability has always had an impact on tourism. You know, Myanmar, for example, has had a fledgling tourism industry. I love Myanmar, but if you look at what's happening now, that will be just as catastrophic on tourism as the pandemic has been. Flashpoints around the region are something to watch, but I think Southeast Asia is really in a good place, probably in a better place than it has been, with the exception of Myanmar. I think, you know, there's relatively relative calmness on the political front. And the other thing is social tolerance, you know, and I draw my attention to Indonesia in particular, you know, this idea that tourism and less social tolerance, especially of the lifestyles of tourists, could have a massive impact on a destination like Indonesia. So I think along with all of those other economic and environmental things, the political and social stability is also going to be quite critical to the extent to which this recovery takes place.
So we've got time for just a couple more questions. So other than looking at, you know, sustainability and those kind of changes, what other factors or behaviours will you be watching and looking at most closely in Southeast Asia once travel finally recommences?
For me, at least, I'm particularly interested to see how Chinese outbound tourism emerges from all of this. If we are to believe that Chinese domestic tourism, or at least tourism within China, has returned to about 85% or thereabouts of the capacity that it has, I see a very large population of travellers just chomping at the bit, wanting to get on that plane, right? So I think what happens to Chinese outbound tourism will have significant ramifications for tourism in Southeast Asia. So I watch that with great interest.
How about you, Mary?
I'm interested in following the geopolitical fallout of the pandemic as it relates to travel mobilities. I think there's a lot of interesting geopolitical narratives at play at the moment. I think that the proposed vaccine passport is going to be quite an interesting and sort of unprecedented move. And so I think it has the capacity to both open up tourism in a safer way, but also by default perpetuate geopolitical inequalities between rich and less wealthy countries, or those with widespread access to the vaccine. And I'm also curious about the so-called travel bubbles that have been proposed for some time and mostly stalled. I think that this is an interesting proposal and something to also watch out for.
So I've noticed from social media, Joseph, that you've been traveling a little bit around Japan during this time. Mary, you mentioned you've been lucky enough to get to know Oahu a lot better. But fingers crossed that we can all get on a plane overseas in the near future. Where will you be traveling to first?
Well, for me, I'll go home to Australia. That's for sure. As I said before, we've just taken this for granted, right? I looked at some airfares. Usually I would pay about $800 an economy airfare to Australia. The last quote I saw for travel next week was $8,000. So, definitely I'll go home to Australia.
Yeah, I'm also going home. For me, everywhere is overseas for sure. So I will be going home to Seattle to visit my parents.
Well, it's been a fascinating chat. We've loved talking to you both, and we could talk on these subjects. But that brings us to the end of this week's show. We hope you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on what we discussed with Joseph and Mary or anything that we missed out. Please drop us an email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show, or on Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, Castbox, Podcast Addict, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app. And if you do listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please give us a review, as that helps other people find the show.
So that's a wrap for this week. Thanks very much to Joseph and to Mary, and we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.